Hey, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Rusick Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to the local music scene and beyond.
Today we have CJ Solar.
He is a singer-songwriter. He's written number one hits for Morgan Wallen, for Jameson Rogers. He's also written for Jason Aldean.
He's also toured with his own band, opening up for acts such as Lynyrd Skynyrd and Hank Jr.
If you're listening to this podcast on Spotify or any other platform, you're going to want to head on over to our YouTube channel at Rusick Podcast. Over there, you can see performance videos with all of our guests. It's awesome. Check it out. Subscribe, follow us. It does help us out a ton. Enjoy. I get this feeling the older I get and the more I go through life that everyone kind of, life just sort of happens to you. And you have to be, you know, you have to work as hard as you can to, to make sure that whatever your role is in that equation that's being filled. But I do kind of feel like life just sort of happens, you know?
It happens to you whether you want it to or not. I guess, you know, it's like, okay, well, do I like make some stuff happen in it?
Yeah.
Like, but you're right. I that's a funny way to look at it. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, obviously you can change certain outcomes, but like, especially when you talk about music, so much of it is not like, oh, wow. It's, well, like, I used to compare, my parents are both OBGYNs.
Oh, really?
Sorry.
All good. My parents are both OBGYNs.
Oh, that's interesting.
And,
okay.
You know, so comparing the music business, what they do, it's like, you know, with a lot of normal paths, there's a clear path to do with what you do. It's like, okay, you go to college, you get good enough grades, you go to med school, you get your residency, and then boom, you're a doctor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But for music business, it's not like, there's no like, oh, well, if you just do this one thing, then this is the next step.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're playing arenas.
And
it's
for
like,
me,
no.
That has been the biggest struggle in life is because I am such an A to B to C to D kind of person.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that's been really fun about this is there are other people out there who are like myself. And then there are other people who are on the other end of the spectrum who aren't like that. And everyone kind of finds their way of making it work. But I think if I have a struggle with it in my life, it's because of that. It's because as a person, that's where my...
Well, yeah, because there's... It's probably one of the reasons that like really, really creative people do so well at it because their lives are just all over the place anyway. So they're just like, well, let me just go hang out and see what happens. Yeah. And then just doing a ton of hanging out and seeing what happens is actually the best way to move further in the music business. Cause it's
for
not,
sure. Yeah.
Cause the other thing that's awkward, like in other businesses, you get in a networking group. They're like, oh, I could use a guy that could like fix cabinets. And they're like, oh, cool. I bank cabinets. Okay, cool. I'll hire you.
Yeah.
But in the music business, it's not often like, I don't know. You don't want to seem like too needy. You know what I mean? It's so, it's a weird thing. I guess
totally.
If you're like a musician and like you run into an artist and he's like, man, I could use a new guitar player. And you're like, well, I play guitar. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like that could be a thing, but often it's like, oh, do you hang out? You know, or are you hanging out with the same crew? Are you,
and
do you dress
so
the same
it.
Way? Or do we mesh? It's not like, you know, there's so many things that go into music business.
That's beyond business.
100%.
I mean, what's funny is because people are like, oh, well, like I'm the best player, but like I'm having a hard time getting a gig. And I'm like, dude, one, you're probably not. But two, there's so many things that go beyond.
Yeah.
Like I even joke, like when I was getting band guys to play with me, I'm like, dude, I would rather a guy who's like 90% hang and 10% player.
We talk about this all the fucking
the inverse.
Time. Yeah. No, I mean, like that is, I think, the sort of hidden wisdom in a lot of this stuff is a lot of it is just the hang. And
well,
that
you're actually hanging with, especially in the
you're on a bus,
or a van or whatever.
Only like, you know, there are 2 hours of your day where you're doing that thing.
Yes.
Everything else is, can I sit down and you know,
throw
down
some
food with this person?
There's at least 24 to 48 hours of being with somebody around those 2 hours of playing music. So it's funny. I've had some great players play with me, but I've definitely like been like, okay, well, this guy's amazing, but this guy is way more fun. You know,
and
he's like 80% of the player, I'll take that.
But I think I think that's the way it is for a lot of things in life. I think in music, it's probably it's probably more front and center just because in music, there is that, as silly as it sounds, there's such a small window where you're actually doing the thing.
Yeah.
So it's probably more exacerbated in something like music, but I bet that's true in any
you're right.
field. You know
well,
what I, mean?
I mean, you know, as everyone
sure,
likes to talk
is.
About, especially, I'm sure it's like this all over the country, but you know, in the South, everyone complains about the good old boys club and it's like, oh, well, you know, if you're a contractor and you're like, you got like someone, two cabinet builders, and one of them's your homie and one of them's just a guy who builds amazing cabinets, but you don't like him that much, you're going to hire your homie, even if he's, you know.
I think most careers have some degree of that.
Some degree of that. But if you're making like really high-end houses, you might be like, well, I don't really, you know, I think it depends on the thing. You're like,
for
well,
sure. Yeah.
These clients are going to want that extra good. And if you're built, you know, so there might be times where you do call that guy just because you're like, I need something a little nicer. But which could be, you know, when you're making an album and you don't hire your band, you hire session players. Like, you're like, man, I love my band, but like, I need someone to crush in a fast window. Yeah. So I don't know. There's a time and a place for a little bit of all of that. Cause I know people that hire session players that they think are really annoying, but they love the way they play, but they're like, well, I don't have to be around them for more than 3 to 6 hours.
And there's wisdom in that too, for sure. I mean, that's another thing that's really, at least for me, kind of captivating, is the difference between someone who is really competent in a session setting and someone who's really competent on tour. As you know, that's a whole other can of worms to open, which is just,
I mean, I don't know if we need to go into that, but it's deep. it's deep. I mean, obviously, most people like start on either, you know, local gigs, then road, then studio. Mm-hmm. But it's like, dude, it's like the 1% of the 1% that like make the transition to fully only in the studio, like playing on huge records. Cause it's just hard.
It always feels like for that kind of thing too, there's a lot of gatekeepers in place because
there are a lot of gatekeepers.
There's a finite amount of anything, I guess. But I think for those jobs are so cherished.
Well, and I think that a lot of the producers, you know, they don't, especially today, you don't get that many opportunities to get in there. Like even me, like I record an EP to a full length album about every year or two.
Yeah.
So it's like, I'm recording like 5 songs a year, basically. You know, so I'm like, dude, every time I hop in there, if I'm going to take a chance on somebody, spend that money. And that's just me. I'm like, I got to make sure that I know that I'm going to walk out with something that's amazing. And if I'm giving somebody young a chance, it's not like Motown where they were just cutting tracks all day, every day and just seeing what happened or Muscle Shoals where they're just like constantly trying stuff and seeing what happened. It's like, nah, dude, so even the big producers in Nashville are like, dude, I'm going to call the guy I've known for 20 years because I just know that he's going to bring the A game. So it's just so hard to break into that until somebody's like, hey, there's this new kid that like is wiping the floor with your old guys. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have to be that good to break in or have some nepotism both.
Or both.
but it's still really hard. It's even with the nepotism, it's still really hard because everyone's like, you're just getting this call. So there's a little bit of some nuance to that, but that's a tough one. I feel like there's 5 to 10 guys on every instrument in Nashville that get all the gigs. But the studio gigs, unless they're like a specialty type thing. But for mainstream country stuff, which is mostly the world that I live in.
What is your, I wanted to ask you, what was your entry into the sort of mainstream pop, whatever you want to call it, like that world of country? How did you get your foot in the door with all
that? I did move here right out of high school and go to Belmont. Okay. So I went to Belmont. And I knew I was a fan of country music. I think in middle school, my parents took us on a trip where we did like Memphis, Nashville, and then like Gatlinburg, where we did like a day or two in each place. And when we came through Nashville, we went to the Grand Ole Opry. And I saw Brad Paisley, Dierks Bentley, and Blake Shelton all in the same night. Then they were all pretty new at that point because this was like 20 years ago. And I was like, this is amazing. These guys are crazy. I thought it was pretty cool. So that kind of like opened my world up to country being cool because I mostly grew up playing classic rock.
Okay.
And
like all of us,
most people who like guitar-based music.
Dad music.
There's something.
Dad music,
I don't know what it is. There's something in the universe. If you hand a guitar, and this is true the last 6 years, if you hand a guitar to a 12-year-old boy, they're going to learn some AC/DC riff.
Like, exactly. It's 100%, dude. 100%. Yes. AC/DC is like almost everybody's starting point.
I can attest
point.
To that Metallica. Every day of my life. Yeah.
You're going to, something in that vein, you're going to do. Yeah. My parents are big on like CCR.
I love CCR.
Yeah, dude, John Fogerty's like,
I think he's one of the best songwriters of all time.
Those are some of the best.
So fucking good.
That was my first favorite band ever, and I started playing guitar when I was like 7, 8. And that was like Bad Moon Rising is DAG the whole time. Yeah. So it's like the songs aren't that, like the riffs can be kind of hard, but like, there's a lot of basic kind of chords, so you could kind of learn those songs pretty easy.
And like, you know, we've talked about this before, but like so much of that stuff, don't get me wrong, it's there's a time and a place to rock out to some AC/DC or insert whatever band like that. But so much of it, as you
as you listen to more things and you kind of expand your taste, you listen back on it and you're like, it's not what I thought it was when I was, 13. But CCR is one of, for me at least, a handful of things. I listen back and I think, holy shit, this is so much better than like 12-year-old Casey thought it was.
Totally, yeah. And what's funny is that a lot of those parts are simple, but they're so good. It's like, it's not like, what was that song from Guitar Hero that everyone was obsessed with, Through the Fire and Flames? Okay, but you know what I mean? Like, where it's just like shredding and tapping, which is, it's obviously cool.
Yeah, there's something cool
but it's
about
like,
that. But
it's
like,
crazy,
yeah.
But like, I mean, Born on the Bayou is one chord for the most part. I mean, there's the little transition, but it's basically just hanging on that one, on that weird E7-y kind of chord.
Yeah.
Almost the whole song. Like, you could kind of skip the other chords and still make it through that song. But it's just, it's a vibe. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, that song just feels so good. So a lot of that stuff was just like, the players were great. The songs were great. Yeah, so that's the stuff that I grew up on. So fast forward. I'm at Belmont. I'm doing the songwriting. I'm actually a songwriting major, which I know is hilarious.
Man, I think you might be the only one, dude.
Might
be the only one.
There's not very many people that got a degree in songwriting that are professional songwriters I know of.
When we were in college, I mean, so like, songwriting is my favorite thing in the world. Yeah. I love songwriting to death. And it was one of those things where I consciously made a decision. Okay, you're not doing that. Solely because I'm like, in my head, which is probably not the right call, as a adult looking back, like, yeah, maybe not the right call, but in the moment it's like, just pure batting average. Like, I don't think
probably
this is
not a great idea. Yeah, so what's funny is that I was gonna come and do the music business, which Belmont songwriting program is like half in the music school, half in the music business school. So you take a lot, like, it's funny. So whenever I took like a visit or whatever, and like, the counselor lady I was meeting with was like, hey, so this music business program is really competitive. And you actually need pretty decent grades from your high school to get into it. And she's like, and you're a little below what we normally take in. But she goes, I got good news for you. And I was like, it's like the Army recruiter. You see those memes where they're like, you're at your whatever that test is they take. It's like, you're going to be a Marine floor scrubber. They were like, we got this brand new songwriting program. And she was like, read my little thing. She was like, kind of sounds like you want to be a songwriter. And I was like, well, I mean, I write songs that suck at this point. But I'm like, I'm trying to be a better songwriter. And she goes, I think you're the perfect candidate, because she goes, it's easier to get into because it's not, you're not actually getting a business degree. But she was like, you get to take a lot of the music business classes, but you get to skip econ and accounting and some of those like things that give you an actual business degree.
Yeah,
so she's like, you're just getting a bachelor's degree.
That's almost exactly what I did. Yeah.
Yeah. But she's like, but you get to take copyright law, sync licensing, publishing, a lot of these like base level music business classes that
which
just
is the
give
shit
you like,
you're going to use,
like, which was definitely some stuff you're going to use. Now, I will say, I do think that just having conversations with professionals could have probably taught me a lot of that knowledge.
For sure.
So, does everybody need to do that? No. My parents were like, hey, you have to go to college. And they did help me. So I can't complain. Would I recommend somebody going into crippling debt to get a songwriting degree? Please don't do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. You really.
If your parents are going to help you out, it is cool. But I will say, there's not only are there cheaper options, there's like, just don't go to college, because the music business doesn't require, like, no, I actually lost my diploma for like the first 10 years. Like, I got home, set it in like a drawer somewhere and forgot it. And I was actually looking for it, and I didn't find it till I moved out of my house like 14 years after I graduated. So I just found my degree like a year ago. I was like, oh my God, I actually have one. But no one's ever asked to see it in the music. You know what I mean? So some of that knowledge was cool. And I will say, and there were some great teachers, and I did have a great time, but what's funny is that I had maxed out all of the music business classes that I could take as part of my minor, because I actually had a songwriting major with a music business minor, but half those classes overlapped. So I had ran out of classes that I could take to finish my minor, and I had to intern my last semester to get the last like 3 credits or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I was like kind of freaking out, because like, those internships were really hard to get, because everyone wanted to intern at all these cool companies. And I was like, how am I going to do this? And I had a guy that lived a couple doors down from me who was working at Universal Publishing at the time. And I hit him up and I was like, hey, dude, I know this is like a Hail Mary. Like, I hit him up in like mid-December looking for a January internship. And I was like, I know this is like terrible timing, and you guys already have them. But I was like, do you know anyone that might need an intern? Because like, I don't think I'm gonna be able to graduate. I'm gonna have to like make up an internship to be able to graduate on time. And he was like, man, I just left Universal for this other company called Seagale. And he goes, honestly, I'm sure I can get you in. I was like, bro, that would be the greatest lifesaver of all time. So he talks to the VP over there and they were like, yeah, you know, Freeman, cool, you're in. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Oh, wow.
So I get this internship, show up, you know, like first, second week of January or whatever. And everyone's just cool. So cool. And they're like, I'm just starting to get to know these people doing whatever, you know, like it's funny because some of the other places that I had like applied intern for and didn't get them, they were like, all right, you're going to do data entry in a cubicle in the corner and you will never talk to anybody. And I was like, what am I going to learn? Yeah, and they were like, I don't know. We basically just use you guys for slave work. I was like, this is terrible. I was like, why would I want this? So at this one, at the company Seagale, they were cool. And it was like, you printed CDs and like,
oh, that's, yeah,
did some odd, you know, like if you had a car, they'd be like, hey, can you go to like Publix and like pick up a case of water? You know what I mean? It was just like the riders could use some waters, but like, it was pretty, pretty basic stuff that was like fun. And you actually got to, so anyway, about 2 weeks in, one of the VPs was like, hey dude, like we always listen to the intern's music just to be nice. If you got any demos or anything you want to show us, like we'll listen to a song or two and just like kind of critique it or, you know, whatever, just like see how it goes. And I was like, oh, sweet. So like literally like immediately I was like, I'm going to go print a CD and just keep it on me until the next time, you know, it makes sense to be like, hey, check this out. And, smart. That was on like a Tuesday. I think I interned Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. So that was on a Tuesday, like my second week. On Thursday, he like walks by my desk and he's like, hey man, I wasn't kidding. If you got a CD, and I was like, got it. You know, nice. And he's like, well, okay, well shoot, pop in. He's like, I got time for like one song. I was like, okay. I had 7 on the CD and, he ended up listening to all of them. And he's like a classic music business thing where I'm in the little chair, he's behind his desk and he like turns his chair back to face the speakers and like puts the CD in. Like,
that's
listen.
Like something out of a Scorsese movie. Oh, I know. Right,
it was classic, dude. It was so classic. Mike, he's since passed away, but he was like the greatest dude ever. But puts it in, hits play and like leans back in his chair. And then like after all, he listens to all 7 songs, like without saying anything. And I'm like, I thought he had time for one. I'm like, oh God, I'm like, what's happening? So he turns around and he goes, not going to lie, way better than I thought it was going to be. And I was like, okay. And he goes, you mind if I show some of the other people around the office this CD? And I was like, please, you know, yeah. And that was it. And then like a week later, so that was on a Thursday. On Friday, a couple of people like came in and were like, hey dude, Mike, show me some of your tunes. They're pretty good. And I was like, oh shit. And like the next week, they called me like one night and they were like, hey, can you come in a little early tomorrow? And I was like, oh crap, I'm in trouble. And I walk in and they're like, you want a deal? And I was like, oh, you know, so I was like a month into this deal, which is funny. Cause when you were doing the intern thing, you had an advisor who you were like checking in with regularly. Mm-hmm. And, I can't remember at what point the guy was like, hey man, like, I feel like you're like kind of behind on your internship assignments, like your journal or some kind of thing. He's like, how's it going over there? And I was like, they just signed me. And he's like, what do you mean they just signed you? I'm like, they gave me a deal. And he was like, oh, dude, you get an A. You know what I mean? He's like, obviously you're doing good. I was like, sweet. You know,
God.
So that was funny. So I got incredibly lucky there. Some of those original songs, actually the Blue Bandana song that I did here, I actually wrote like a couple weeks before they signed me, which is really cool. And they took some of the songs around and that one ended up getting cut. It was my first cut and ended up being a single on a guy named Jared Neiman. On Sony at that time, it got up to like number 30 on the charts. And then what's funny is they hired a new president at Sony and he dropped the song, pulled the song off the radio. I was like, man, I got my first big win and I got my first big nut kick really fast, which was really
probably a good lesson there.
Learned
somewhere.
All the lessons.
I think
quick,
so. Yeah. You know what I mean? It was like, it was really funny. It sucked at the time. Cause I was like, wow, this is the difference between like buying a new guitar and buying a house. you know, I was like, especially at that time, 10 years ago, I was like, oh, this sucks. But, you know, is what it is, but it was really cool. So that was sweet. I ended up getting over the next couple of years a couple more album cuts with some other big artists like Justin Moore and Jason Aldean, and I got a cut in 2017 with this new artist at the time named Morgan Wallen, who is huge now, and which is crazy, and ended up being his first number 1, a song called Up Down. That I also played for the videos.
If you're paying attention. If you're following along at home.
Link in the description.
Link in bio. But
So yeah, that was just to pause on that for a second. What was that like to have that first? I mean, because I'm sure, you know, getting to that point, you had seen various forms of success with your songwriting, but to have that sort of stamp of approval of, oh shit, this is a number one. Fuck. Like, what did that feel like?
Man, it was crazy. You know, it's funny because I signed that deal in 2014. I wrote that song that went number one in 2015. It got released in 2017, went number one in 2018. So things just move so slow in the music business. Like the whole, what is it? Hurry up and wait, you know, as with everything, when you're playing shows, anything. It's really frustrating, but at the same time, it was just a weird feeling of like, okay, something that I did 4 years ago or however long, 3 years ago, is like successful now. Because it's funny because everyone all of a sudden is like, oh my God, that's amazing. Like, we should work together. You know what I mean? It all of a sudden validates you. You're like, I was doing the same thing 3 years ago, but whatever. Yeah. So it's cool. It was really cool, man. I mean, it opened a lot of doors for me. That other song I played, Watered Down Whiskey, like, it helped me get to play at the Grand Ole Opry. Which was like really at the top of my bucket list when I moved to town. So that was really cool. And yeah, I mean, it helped me book better shows and do all kinds of stuff. So it's been a real blessing. And you know, forever grateful to Morgan Wallen and his team for believing in that song, and, you know, really did change my life. So yeah, that was really crazy. It felt really cool. And you know, it's funny, like, I think that song is very catchy and is fun. Did I think it was going to be the song that changed my life? No, I didn't. But what's funny is that I wrote a lot of songs in that vein at that time. And country music at that time was living in this, I jokingly call it simp country, but it was like boyfriend country. Yeah. And it was like really lovey-dovey. It was very lovey-dovey at that time because everyone was almost like rebelling against Florida Georgia Line's initial like bro country thing. And everyone's like, man, the whole redneck kind of thing is not – it's not hot right now. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I got like this Southern rock leaning thing that I do. And it's just funny that song just got heard by Morgan Wallen's manager. And he was like, man, this guy could, Morgan Wallen could really use this song. And it's not really what FGL's doing, but then they featured on it and they were the biggest band in the genre at the time. So that kind of helped pull Morgan Wallen up a little bit. And he was out on tour with them. And
when this is transpiring, and not just to kind of sit in this particular one, but I'm just curious, when all this is transpiring, are you sort of skeptical as, because like you said, I mean, as I used to work in music publishing myself, and it is a lot of just, it's the long game. Everything
it is
takes
a long
forever.
Game. Yeah.
And as you're sitting through all that, does it feel like, in the back of your head, you're like, oh, this isn't gonna pan out. Like, this isn't gonna, or are you kind of rooting for it?
You
like,
know, I think you almost have to just have blind optimism.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I've been incredibly blessed with so many things in my life, but like, I think one of the things you have to do in the music business is have just completely unrealistic blind optimism that everything's gonna work out.
It's manifest,
you know what I mean?
It
you really
into
do.
Reality.
Yeah, yeah, you really do. Because if you're just like, oh, this is like, I mean, and I have those conversations with co-writers all the time. We're like, man, the music business sucks, and we dissect why it sucks. Because it's really easy to do that. Because it does suck. But still believing in yourself and just thinking like, I can't remember who said it. It was like, well, somebody's gonna do it, might as well be me. And it's like, I might as well, you know, believing in yourself, your talent, whatever you have, and just, you know, I don't know, going to work at it. Like, I mean, I was very fortunate that coming right out of college, I got a songwriting deal that paid me enough to live and not have to go scoop Chipotle at the moment, because that's probably what I would have done, because I love Chipotle, if they would have given me some for free. you know, it just allowed me to write like songs 5 days a week I just left my last company, but I had a deal for like 11 years straight is whenever I signed. So being able to do that, just allowed me to write a ton of songs and just have a lot of stuff. And it not only fed my own artist career to have my own songs that I can release and do myself, but have other songs that I get to pitch to other people. So, I don't know, man. I felt like believing in myself and just going, hey, look, I might as well do this and hope for the best. It's like kind of, I don't know. I've just always thought that. And, you know, the game's changed
like the
multiple times.
Yeah.
I think you know, like life just happens to you. We were talking earlier. It's like, yeah, it kind of does. It's like, you just have to like try to give yourself the best opportunities around what's potentially, you know, going to happen for you. Did I foresee in any of the success I've had happening the way it did? Absolutely not. None of it has been anything that I like planned. But I think that's just one of the things is you just got to like, put yourself out there. Which is very, you know, in an art business, it's hard because you're like vulnerable with your art and everything, but you just got to put it out there, which is funny because now that the internet's so big, like there's so many terrible people putting art everywhere. It almost like ruins it because you see like really high quality videos. I almost think our algorithms are just punking us by putting bad music in front of our faces.
Brian's algorithm, he intentionally looks at bad music. So he loves
one of
bad
my
music.
Favorite things is finding just terrible artists on Instagram.
It's so easy.
If you look and at Instagram shit, knows I
it knows
love
you like
it.
Them. It's I have certain like friend chats on there that everyone just shares that. So yeah,
I send random clips I find to Casey all the time.
It's brutal. But I'm like,
it's hilarious.
But when do they show you music that's good?
Never. True.
Like
never.
I don't know. Maybe normies who like good music are getting that, but like I feel like you're more likely to share something that's bad than you are to share something that's good.
Yeah, I wonder why that is.
I know exactly why it is because
like if something sucks, like it probably gets more engagement, like more people comment on it,
and they're sending
like,
it to their friends, and it just feeds the algorithm because like it's getting shared. It's like but it's getting shared because people are making fun of it.
There's something naturally cynical about the internet, or at least there's something where I think the internet can sort of naturally lean towards cynicism. So a lot of things like that is people, it's because people do exactly what you and I do, which is we just shit post and send these things to each other. Cause we think, look at this thing.
But I'm like, no one is sharing good music.
Yeah.
Like I never, and people constantly ask me like, oh dude, have you heard of this new guy? He's awesome. I'm like, never heard of him ever. Like, has it passed by me one time? I'm like, where would I have heard this person? They're like, oh, they're on Instagram. They're out there. I'm like, maybe not my algorithm, you know.
Yeah, maybe you just have to like quickly scroll past the bad shit to like the algorithm knows. Yeah. Oh, okay, this guy wants.
There's so
good
many
music.
New artists who are like making waves that I just like don't hear about until they're like on the radio. Which by the time you make it to radio, you've already blown up.
I mean,
like,
there's so many good artists out there that it's like,
I'm like, who's this person? They're like, dude, they got a million followers. Have you never heard of them? Yeah. I'm like, my algorithm's just like freaking
dog shit.
The worst songs ever. And maybe that's just a music business thing because we're like, wow, who would put this out there? Which is really mean, but is what it is.
But I think it's also you know, as someone who this is your life, there's a certain standard in which you hold yourself to. And when you see people that are drastically below that standard, you think, Is this real? Is it someone punking me?
You know, you kind of do think that you're like, are they messing with us? Yeah. Most of them are not.
I hope.
I don't go to Instagram to search for good music. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, I think Instagram is not a discovery platform. Yeah. It is a shit posting platform.
Exactly.
Your friends just like sharing things that make you laugh. Like that's what I use Instagram for.
I think that's what we all do.
I think normies, aka not music businessy people, maybe use TikTok to scroll and find things that they think they might like.
Yeah.
Because, like, I use TikTok as an artist, and people do discover me on there. Almost nobody brand new is discovering me on Instagram. It's usually just people that already find out about me. They see I'm playing a show. Like, that's the only new followers I get, or maybe just people that are like, oh, so you're playing something, or, you know, it's not very much like, oh, wow, your video popped up on my Discover page.
That's so funny because I feel like for us, I mean, obviously we're on a much sort of smaller scale at the moment, but our experience is kind of the opposite. Whereas,
oh, really?
It's sort of interesting. We get a lot of people through Instagram, and like a lot of people, you know, follow or reach out or that kind of thing. So we get a lot of engagement there, but TikTok. Much less engagement. It's really interesting.
I think it's because we get a lot of people because we collaborate with the people.
Yeah,
we
that's
have
true.
On.
That's very true.
So you naturally just get followers.
Some of their followers.
I don't know. I don't do TikTok. Is there even a way to do that on TikTok? Or
no, I mean, you
like
can do like
post
tag
to both
stuff.
Pages.
I've never collaborated.
I don't think you can collab in the same way.
Sure.
As someone who,
I don't know.
As someone who like your job, for lack of a better word, is you're a songwriter.
Yeah.
I also know that you just are passionate about songwriting and that's something that you love. Has there been a skill you've had to develop to find a balance between, okay, I'm doing this because I love it, and no, I've got to churn out these tunes because this is how I'm feeding myself. You know, like where do you find that balance
now? I don't
know.
I feel like I've always had this thing, and I've joked that like All right, so you have like cool, less commercial music over here, and then you have like the most commercial over here, music over here. And usually these fans don't overlap that much. And I feel like I've always tried to like somehow wind up riding the middle, and then I just joke that I just jump over and miss both fan bases. But I feel like I'm always trying to do commercial music with like cool musical lyrical elements that like have pieces of both of these things. Which again, like I said, I feel like half the time it just like these people and these people don't like it. But there are people out there that obviously I do have some fans and that I'm super blessed. But yeah, it's hard trying to balance doing what you want. I feel like I just try, like when I get in the writer room every day, to be like, what do I like? And, you know, try to, I do like commercial music when it's good and done right. So I'm like, try to do just, I just try to make stuff that I think I would genuinely enjoy listening to, and hope that there's other people out there that would like that too. You know, it's hard like trying to force yourself to do stuff that you don't want to do, but I don't know. I think my tastes are like stuff that a lot of people would like. And then the like weirder side of things I can like dabble in every now and then. But I don't know. It's definitely not easy trying to like write hit commercial songs like every day. Like it can be a little bit of a brain beat down.
And not to get lost in the weeds here, but I think it's worth kind of sitting in for a second. Like, what do you find on the sort of mechanical nuts and bolts level? What do you find is the difference between writing for something that would be more commercial versus something that is more for you, the sort of the artistry of it? Like what do you find are the primary difference? I mean, not to like peek behind the curtain too much, but I think it's something that interests people, because it is, I mean, it is a different sandbox you're playing in.
Country music is just so weird at this point, where there's so many lanes and it goes through phases, but this post-COVID world, you've got, I mean, and I jokingly call it, you've got like people doing like a metal country thing. You've got super pop country. You've got, I jokingly call it simp country. You got all these different lanes of like vibes that everybody's doing. So it's a weird thing where it's almost hard to write. Pre-COVID, everyone was doing the same thing. So you just wrote a song that kind of felt like what everybody was doing at that moment. And it had a lot of avenues, and you still have that a little bit, but, I don't know. I just, you know, kind of keeping what's happening at the moment in your mind. But like, I try to not chase that myself. Like my growing up playing a ton of like CCR classic Southern, a lot of Southern rock kind of stuff, that stuff just always threads through what I do. So I think having like a big background and, you know, when I was in high school playing 4-hour cover gigs every weekend and like having a good foundation musically, good enough to write songs around and you know, and things that I like to do melodically, that I feel like I have a lot of that flowing through my tunes. And then really it's just like, okay, well, how commercial is this lyric? Are we getting weird with it? Is it just a really down the middle thing?
So I always saying, and not to derail you here, but when you're saying how commercial is this lyric, for people listening who don't have this context, are you talking about how sort of accessible, how generally accessible is this lyric to people? Or is it more like the content that you're dealing with?
I think it's two things. It's like, is this a weird concept that's not your average country radio?
Is it outside
thought?
The box?
Is it outside the box? Is it of that? And then melodically too, you go, well, I don't know, does this feel like a Chris Isaac song? Okay, well, it's not commercial country. You know what I mean? But like your lyric can still, and then you go, okay, well, we can have like this weird Chris Isaac-y melody, but a more mainstream lyric. So you go, where's the push and pull of like, what's keeping this in mainstream land? Because like I've written some songs that were like super weird melodically, but very mainstream lyrically. And then country artists like it. And you can almost do the inverse where you're like weird lyrics, but it feels just good. So I don't know. It's like, and I think different concepts can lend themselves to like more interesting like metaphors or lyrics. Like I have a song that's going to be on my next record called 10,000 Lighters. And I've joked that it's a song about banging in a truck bed. But the song is... But all of the like metaphors are like you're hanging out with a girl in a truck bed, and you're comparing it to playing a stadium show. And as you're looking up at the stars, it's like it's almost like you're getting an encore. It's like 10,000 lighters shining back at us is the general thought. Yeah, so yeah, it's like, it's a mildly interest. It's an interesting way of basically saying like, wow, we're laying out here looking up at the stars and it's almost like they're cheering us on as we're laying in this truck bed, potentially, you know, banging. But that's like,
potentially,
you know, potentially, you know, if everything goes right, but that's like, that's the gist of that song. Yeah. And it's not like, and I joke as I've been like, I just started like playing it at like some acoustic shows. I'm like, all right, well, here's a song about banging in a truck bed from a different point of view. You know what I mean? It's like, and I was like, country radio could use another one of those, but it's like, you know, so I try to find in my, is interesting to me, finding just a slightly different way, to say the same stuff. Cause that's, I mean, that's what we're all doing anyway, but at least from a mainstream country music standpoint, it's like, okay, well, what's making this fresh? Is it melody? I don't like just doing, and I write these all the time because you kind of have to, but like, I love finding a way to not just do 1, 4, 6, 5 and some super generic title and some melody that sounds like a amalgamation of every melody you've ever heard that is a snooze fest. Like, the world doesn't need more mediocre songs. Like, there's so much mediocre out there. Because what's funny is when you're really bad, you're going to wind up on our algorithms. And when you're really good, you know what I mean? Like, but like everything that's in the middle just kind of like, it just kind of chills. You know what I mean? Okay music, like, is fine, but it's not breaking the mold. And it's hard because, like, I'm sure there's a ton of people who would think that all of our music is mediocre. And that's fine. But you got to find your people, your lane, and people that find your stuff interesting. And I've been thinking about that even more lately from like a niche, standpoint. It's like really find, like, figuring out who your audience is, what kind of people would like your music. I think in this like post COVID world, it's so much more like narrowing down like your like key fans. Like, you look at, country music and you have Jelly Roll, Luke Combs, Morgan Wallen, Lainey Wilson, a lot of the like diehards of these fans are like, they're like the most extreme version of that. Like, Jelly Roll is like an ex drug dealer with face tats, and like his most diehard fans are like watered down versions of him. You know what I mean? It's like, not, you know what I mean? Like,
no, I get what
it's
you mean,
people
yeah.
who like are maybe dealing with some substance abuse that can deal with those, that can feel his, so his lyrics and his personality are almost what's connecting with people more. It's like a brand. The brand is connecting with the fans more than I think even the music is.
So what do you think, allows for that differentiation between, at least in the country songwriting world, the pre-COVID and the post-COVID, the pre-COVID and post-COVID world? What do you think is the difference? Like, why do you think that there are these changes that have happened since
Well, I think
then?
Everyone started, like, okay,
that
so
the shittiest way to ask.
No,
that
I know
question.
What you mean. Really All right, so in pre-COVID, and it stopped working as we were getting closer to 2020. This is, you know, country radio was like the thing that dictated whether you were a star or not.
Yeah, COVID was more the catalyst than it was sort of the straw that broke the camel's
back. It's the
it
straw that
so
broke
much,
the camel's
yeah.
back. So, like, before COVID, if you get 3 or 4 songs to ring the bell way up on the chart at number one on the country radio, people just knew who you were because they're, especially if you had like somewhat of a unique sound and everyone was talking about you, that's how you got buzz. Post COVID, it's all online. You don't get on the radio until you blow up huge online. So you have to do that and everyone's annoyed about it, but it's just like they're, I was talking to some, a publisher a day or two ago and they're like, well, man, now you can shove a song up radio and nobody cares because radio is like the last,
yes,
the last
stop,
piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to break online for radio to even care. You can go spend $1 million promoting your song to radio, have it go number one, and nobody will know because the people aren't really discovering music there. It's like, those songs are getting played like 6 months after they're popular online.
Yeah.
Like the people who are the least plugged into like following, it's the most passive fan. And because those fans are passive, they don't hear a song on there and go, ooh, I wonder who that is. It's just back, you know, it's almost, it's the most passive. So the most active fans are finding the new stuff online and you have to find a way to reach those people. And then your marketing and your branding is a big part of the way that people like that music. So it's almost, it's really depressing, but it's like, the music is the least important part of the puzzle. The branding, I think, is almost everything. I mean, even pre-COVID, like Luke Bryan and Blake Shelton being like on The Voice and American Idol, that was like more of a brand thing than it was like people like them for who they were. Not that their music was like inherently bad, but people liked them because of their personalities, not because they were the best music people.
Yeah. And it's something, I think it's something that you see very clearly in things like the podcast space, where I think the reason why people come back to shows that they like to listen to. And I think this is starting to also be true of other facets of art, like music as well. But the reason why you throw the headphones on when you're on the treadmill or grocery shopping or whatever is because you feel like you have a relationship with that person. Even if it's, you know, someone you've never 100%. Met, you feel like, oh, I kind of know this person. I know where they stand. I think if I, you know, was at the bar with them, I'd be able to like have a drink and hang out and have a good time. And that's the thing that I think is really dictating the market now is this feeling of, do I feel like I know who this person is? Now, sometimes, with that said, somebody's skill and talent, et cetera, can be so potent that stuff's irrelevant. And like, you know, you can think of whatever, you know, whomever, you can think of whatever person you want to insert there who's just so otherworldly talent. Like if Michael Jackson was alive right now, nobody gives a shit if he's on Instagram. It's like, he's going to be Michael Jackson to a degree, right?
He might be writing songs for the hot person and not doing it himself.
But I guess my point is that there's an escape velocity you can reach to a degree where that may not be necessarily always the case. But for the most part, the vast, vast, vast majority of the time, there is that connection that's needed for people. There's that connection.
Well, what's funny is that I think, you know, from the probably 60s to early 2000s, it was just what music is great that the labels decided to allow into the world. Because there were gatekeepers, but if the music was really, really great, often there was a chance that it was going to get put out there because they signed and put out people all the time. And the branding was definitely part of it, but like it didn't have to be like, Steve Miller Band doesn't have great branding. He has a logo with a horse.
I
saw your post. I just thought about that.
Oh my God, dude.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. But nobody knows what Steve Miller looks like. You know what I mean? But the music's awesome.
I didn't until like 3 weeks ago. Fucking so
it's incredible.
Good.
Yeah, but like there's not much branding there. He's got the Pegasus logo. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all you know about Steve Miller Band is like one cool logo.
And not to steer into the world of cynicism here, but one of the things that I think is really kind of nice about that, like I like that there is an element of mystery. Like when the Stones started to kind of to cross over here, I like that there's an element of mystery of like, oh, wait, who are these guys? Yes. Wait, is that the drummer? Is that like there's something
that's
cool
one of the biggest
that.
Differences of today is where when you have to constantly post your face online to promote yourself, there's no like mysticism about these artists. You know everything about them.
Yeah.
And really, you can't have rock stars today.
You can't.
I think that's
the worst
thing because like even in the early 2000s, you could like do heroin and crash your car and you know and like wind up in the tabloids and everyone be like, wow, that's crazy. And maybe you saw like one picture of them like getting pulled out of their car drunk and you would be like, whoa, what a rock star. But now like every single like 20 people will have a different angle of it and you're like and now they'll catch the piss in your pants on the phone. You know what I mean? Like it's like, you know, the classic
it takes
picture,
some of the romanticism out of it. And it does. Genuinely does.
Well, I mean, if you saw a modern picture of you know that classic picture of Johnny Cash eating cake high in the woods.
Exactly.
That would just be sad now. But now you're like, damn, that was rock star. But, but like back then. But now you're like, that's depressing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you just can't do that. And it was counterculture back then. I mean, the same way tattoos were counterculture back then. It's like, well now, like to be a rapper, you have to have a face tat. Yeah. We're like, you know what I mean? But like,
I was going
to
ask, when is your face tat coming?
I know. I don't have
you
a single
jump
tat.
On the
I know.
Right? I'm the same way. I feel like I'm the only guy in East Nashville not to have a tat anywhere.
It's more rare, you know, and not to have anything against tattoos, but you know, it's funny. I was like, they originally were a counterculture thing, but I'm like, when every single cop I know has a full sleeve, it's not really a counterculture.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, I like tattoos and I think they're cool and I've had ideas. I've just never pulled the trigger on one.
Yeah.
But I'm like, it's not like you don't see a tattoo and go, ooh, that guy's got to be a biker who like sells drugs. You know, like
they're not rebellious anymore.
No, but that's just the whole societal type thing that we have behind art is like, yeah, it's changed. It's not like these cool, mysterious figures that live outside the lines. It's like, you can't even be that. Like, and
a lot of it's dependent on personality too. Like for me, my entire life, my relationship to whatever that image is, you know, air quotes around image, has always been curated and guarded. And to me, that's sort of a set, you know, it is very thought through. And I don't want too much of, I like having that curtain there. Yeah. I like that you can peek behind a little bit, but I like that. And this is really, for me, this is the first thing I've ever done where it's just Brian and I. And I think when we started doing this, we were just saying, okay, the only way to do this is if there is no bullshit attached to it.
Yeah.
And there's something I really genuinely enjoy about the dichotomy of those two things. About, yes, I think that there is something beautiful about the romanticism and about that sort of, maybe not guarded, but that curated image of what you want to put out there into the market. I think there is some value to that. But I also think there's some value to just being yourself and fucking around and not worrying about that.
I think in today's age, you have to find that balance.
Yeah.
Because even like your Instagram is like a very curated version
of
yourself. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, you can't just post like bad selfies all the time. But like, if you want to look pro, you got to have like that's your like bio. You know what I mean? You scroll through, you're like, you see good pictures and you're like, okay, this person's legit. And it's a very curated version of yourself. So I do see that, but people love to see behind the scenes. And if you're not, I mean, I don't know, everyone, every manager or anyone who I've even thought about working with is like, well, you got to be posting all this personal stuff. You got to constantly post. And they're like, if you're constantly posting, I'm like, dude, I can't, my entire life can't be manufactured. Like I have to go do normal things.
Oh my God. I used to have this management company. This was probably 3 or 4 years ago now. And they would ride me about the same stuff. And like, and I think a lot of it too is because I always had this aversion to letting people in. Yeah. I just don't, as a consumer, I don't care for that. I mean, and I think that's why I say a lot of it is personality. As a consumer, I don't really care. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to know what John Bonham had for breakfast. No. I just want to hear for those 2 hours he's on stage that night. I just want to rock out. You know what I mean?
All of our lives aren't that interesting.
Exactly.
I know everyone posts everything about their life, but like the people that just post everything they eat, I'm like, please just like, unless you're like the biggest foodie and billionaire who just eats eccentric stuff all the time, I don't care what Mexican place you're eating at tonight.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like if you post every now and then, but like, it just got to be a thing where everyone felt the need to post everything they were doing. I'm like, I don't need to see you taking a dump. Everyone takes a dump. You know what I mean? It's just like annoying.
There's nothing like open up a story and it's a good shit photo. Like everyone.
You must have better friends than I have because my friends aren't posting their dump photos. But yeah, I don't know, dude. Because like people would be like, you need to post more about your life. I'm like, dude, and that could be a thing because I do think that our heroes like spent their lives trying to be great at music, creating great music, putting it out there. And then once they became famous, maybe they got drug problems and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. But for us, it's like, okay, well, I'm trying to like live a normal life somewhat while like making music full time or, you know, around whatever else I'm doing. But like fans don't really care. You're like, they're like, some people will be like, oh, do like a day in the life of CJ. I'm like, okay, wake up. Like, especially like 10 years ago when I was like, first getting my, you know, when I was a little bit younger and like writing Uptown, it's like, okay, wake up at 10:30, go to an office, sit there for four hours and make something up, then go eat Chipotle and then like go hang out. Like there's nothing interesting there, you know? So people are like, oh, like people need to see behind the curtain. I'm like, what's behind the curtain? Yeah. I'm doing the same thing everybody else is doing. Yeah. I'm just hanging out. You know, I just don't have to sit in a cubicle to do accounting. I'm sitting in a cubicle to write songs.
Well, but like, it also makes you wonder, like, people who are doing those kind of videos, how much of...
You know it's manufactured. It's completely manufactured.
Completely.
And that's the other thing.
There's probably a lot of shit that just, okay, I'm going to do this so I can put it in my day in the life video. You know,
well, it's a lot of those, like, LA influencers that, like, go rent a house for the day, film a month's worth of content at a mansion they don't even live in, and then they go back to their slum in Ohio.
You don't know this is what we're doing right now. This isn't actually their house.
This house is rented.
They live in a shack. This is...
But, I mean, that's so... I mean, like, I know I've seen where they're like, oh, that's, like, a thing in LA. Or, like, people will, like... You know, there's like a jet that doesn't run that everyone in LA uses to make it look like they're flying on a private plane. Like everyone's trying to look like their life is so interesting when it's not. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, I don't want to do that. Like I signed up to play music. I mean, I know that being an influencer is different than playing music. But at the same time, when you play music, they want you to be an influencer. And I'm like, I don't want to be a fucking influencer. I hate that. Like, I hate the word influencer. I want to play music. And like, which I feel like my life is significantly more interesting post COVID because I like, before I was just, all I did was music. And then like COVID made me like kind of step out and like start doing jujitsu where we met and, you know, bought a moped, a dirt bike, whatever you want to call it.
There you go.
We don't have it anymore. But you know what I mean? It's like, I started, just getting into other things and I'm like, okay, well my life's a little bit more interesting now, but at the same time, it's not that interesting. I just have music. I have a couple hobbies outside of music, but it's not.
I think you'd be surprised what like people want to see. Cause like there's people who get tons of views on shit that I don't find interesting at all. But like, like some of the shit you see these like live streamers and stuff doing and like vlogs.
But it's like when people play video games and like kids will like watch someone else like, play a video.
Some of these like vloggers or whatever, they'll get millions of views and like, this is what I'm eating for breakfast.
That kind of becomes like, their full-time thing. Yeah. Where people are like, oh, you should do that too. And I'm like, well, my full-time thing is playing music. But if I'm going to start vlogging about my food, that's another full-time job on top of. Like, if you're streaming your video games, you got to be really good at playing video games. Like, playing video games like 8 hours a day for like probably 10 years to get to a point where someone cares to watch you play them.
Exactly.
And everyone's like, oh, you kind of like Call of Duty. And I'm like, yeah, but I suck and I haven't played in 5 years. They're like, well, why don't you get on there and stream it? I'm like, well, I suck. No one's going to watch me, even though I'm like an aspire. It'd be one thing if I was Post Malone and everyone just got on there and laughed that I suck.
Yeah.
But like, you know what I mean? So there's like, there's gotta be like, I had a guy who wanted to manage me once and he was like, man, I'm working with this girl and she's so good. Like she plays guitar and she like her videos just keep blowing up on TikTok. And I'm like, pull it up. And I'm like, yeah, cause she's a cute girl playing guitar. Every creep who plays guitar is commenting, oh, you're so hot. You play guitar. Great. I'm like, she's okay. You know what I mean? Like, it's totally different as a dude. I mean, you know what I mean?
Sure.
I'm like, there's reasons
totally
that certain
world.
Things blow up. And I'm like, you're like, well, you just got to find one. I'm like, I'm a mediocre looking guy with what I consider above average music. And no one cares that the music's good. You know what I mean? It's like, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, I guess if I could like get a six pack and just sing all my shirts with just all my songs with my shirt off, then maybe somebody would care. But I'm like, really? Do I want to build my brand on showing the abs I don't have yet?
Yeah.
No. I don't know. You know what I mean? You gotta find something, but I'm like, I don't have abs. So
I also think that there is a world where like all this like superficial shit doesn't matter. Like, yeah, it's not going to like hit the mainstream, but there still is like a niche audience for whatever it is that you do, as long as you're making something
and
that's good.
I'm finding it and continuing to try and find that. It would be nice to bump to a level where you're like playing, you know, big theaters, arenas, maybe, you know what I mean? Like that would be sweet. That would be awesome. I just don't know how you like really post COVID, like Zach Bryan, there's only a handful of people that have like become really huge, mostly via TikTok. There's a lot of like people that get millions of followers, but it doesn't even translate to like an arena. Like, like Zach Bryan's like honestly one of the only ones. Like there's maybe a couple others, but I can't think of how many superstars have been made post COVID.
Yeah, there's something difficult to articulate about. There's one thing to see a mass of numbers behind someone. Mm-hmm. It's another thing for those to translate to the real world.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is. It's very hard to.
I find it interesting because even with this show, we'll collab on stuff with people on Instagram and like, people like the amount of followers that person has, it does not always translate to people coming over and watching the show. Like we've had people with, you know, way less followers than this person with big followers. Mm-hmm. And like the person with the ton of followers, like few people went over, and then like, you know, someone with way less followers, you know, a bunch of people came over and watched the show.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it doesn't always translate. Sometimes you just get a clip that goes viral and you have people enjoy it on a surface level, but they're not really like a fan. They just followed you because they liked that.
Yeah, whatever that was. Yeah.
Yeah.
As someone who clocks in every day as a songwriter, I have to imagine that you must have some form of shortcuts that you can use when you're sitting down. Okay. Whether it's starting with melody first, lyric first, I don't know what your approach is, but what have you found to be your sort of tool belt or your current tool belt of shortcuts just to get that spark going so you can actually get some kind of output?
Having
at the end of the
collaborators
day.
Is huge. Okay. I rarely write an entire song by myself anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, my typical, a typical main, you know, Nashville co-write, usually doesn't start, it starts at 11 you get in, you start BSing, 30 minutes to an hour. You either come up with something through conversation that's an organic, like, oh my God, you just got dumped. Cool. That's like, you just said like, oh, if only she hadn't broke my heart in two or whatever. You know what I mean? You go, oh, that sounds like a song title. Okay, cool. You're actually going through that. Let's turn it into a song. Or you go, all right, guys, well, let's break out our idea books and throw some stuff around and see who has a moderately interesting title.
So and really, it's just whatever. Normally start title first then if you're in
we
that
normally
situation.
Start at least, I like to have a title, a hook, or a concept. You know, it's like, oh man, but it's funny because like sometimes somebody comes and they're like, I'd really like to write a song about my dead grandpa, and you're like,
that you know, one, you're like, okay,
well,
you.
You're like, well, okay, well, like, is there a concept around it? Is it like, oh, well, he had this like 57 Chevy that we always worked on? Like, is there what is it about it? You know, like, what is the concept? Or he had some saying he said. I saw somebody put out a song the other day, and it was like, chicks want me, fish fear me or something, and I was like, my grandma always said this. I'm like, that's hilarious.
You know, I'm gonna start going around and looking at like Hinge prompt answers.
You could.
And I'm gonna start turning
those
into songs. That's
yeah.
what I'm gonna start
well,
doing.
Well, somebody was telling me that there was a hit songwriter years ago who was like, seeing like girls on Instagram that were like, he would just see like their captions. He was like trying to find song ideas and like
that's hilarious.
Captions of like girls' idea, you know, their in their photos.
I'm sorry.
No. I like to come up with that, and then I like to just think, okay, what should, like, I don't know, just because I've been doing it so long, I feel like I either like immediately feel like I know how to write the song, some of the angles, at least have a general direction of which way to go, and then I just try to start like almost singing stuff that I feel like should feel like that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you nail it, sometimes you don't. You know, it's like I have writing songs 3 to 5 times a week for the last like 11 years. I got a ton of songs and a lot of them suck. You know, I think that's one of the good things about the numbers game of writing a lot is that inevitably not every song is going to be great, but you got a lot of them. So I do have a lot of songs to choose from when I'm picking stuff or pitching stuff. But not every song is going to be great. And there could be a thing where you go, I'm only going to write 12 songs a year and I'm only going to finish the ones that are like amazing. And you could have just as many great songs as I have. And I, you know what I mean by songs
no,
that I think
yeah,
are good.
Yeah, exactly.
You could go, okay, well, I'm only going to write the best ideas and just chisel them. That's just not my process.
Yeah, I do think at the end of the day, it's a numbers game like most things. And you just need to put, it's like anything. You need to put the time in. I mean, for everyone.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, I mean, there was this guy, I think his name is Preston Leatherwood, who was an old hit songwriter.
That is a great fucking name.
That's a great name.
Preston Leatherwood?
I'm pretty sure it's a dude's name. He had a couple hits way back in the day.
It should be now, but it's not.
And somebody told me I don't think he ever lived in Nashville. I could be wrong. But that he only wrote like 12 songs a year by himself, and like all of them would get cut because he just like would spend like weeks mm-hmm. on one song and just make sure every line was bulletproof, every melody was solid. And it's like, okay, well, you know, like you can do it that way.
Yeah.
But I think some of those people are more like the thinkers. And my first publisher told me that he, this concept, he goes, man, I feel like there's two types of writers. There's heart writers and head writers. And head writers sit there and just like think about lyrics for like hours and hours and they're just sculpting. And like, then you have people who come up with stuff from the heart and you're just jamming, you're singing, you're just flowing. And obviously you want it to make sense. But at the same time, you're just like, you're either hit with the inspiration and you just get everything down and kind of piece it together. And I feel like that's kind of more my thing. I obviously want my songs to make sense. But at the same time, like, I feel like I'm either just hit with something and it's like, cool, I need to get it out and melodically. And there's just a spark there, wherever it's coming from, you just get it out and then kind of sculpt it into something. So I don't know. I think you got to kind of figure out what kind of a writer you are. I think that there's probably other kinds, but that's like, to the at least in Nashville, I run across those two, you know, all the time, and sometimes it's nice to have a guy who will just sit there and sculpt your lyric and make it make better sense than what you could. But you have such a great melodic sense that you can, you know, and you guys agree on a concept that they just turn the lyric into something really great and use your melodies or whatever. But yeah,
I've never done a co-write in my life. I did one.
That is interesting.
I did one year, a handful of years ago. My management set me up with this guy who'd done a lot of great stuff around town, and they sent me to him. Super nice guy.
Yeah.
And so, I forgive me for anyone who's heard this, but I write completely in character. So about a handful of years ago, I just got sick of going on stage and playing these songs and thinking, like, why does anyone up here fucking care what I have to say about literally anything? Like, I'd go up there and I'd be just like, it would like piss me off. I'd be like, I don't fucking care what I have to say about anything. Like, why do they care, you know?
Yeah.
And it just got to this point where, and don't get me wrong, so many people that I just absolutely admire and love as songwriters go that route, and I absolutely love their output. But for me, just creatively, it got to a point where I just felt like, this is just, why am I doing this? And so in the last handful of years now, because time flies, I write exclusively in character. And so I'll sit with a character at first and just have them for a while in my head.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they'll say something. And usually it's something that I'm not expecting, right? Usually it's something that is kind of out of left field, or, oh, that's not where I thought that.
Yeah. And that's a cool way to do
it. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of things that go along with writing a character. I mean, to me, again, this is stuff any listener knows, so I apologize. But to me, it's the same idea as writing a novel.
It's a little bit more in that, yeah, in that process, like but it's a cool musical thing.
If I'm going to do that, I want the same freedom that I would have sitting down as a novelist or, writing a script for a film.
It's a cool way to do it. And it's pretty unique.
But I remember I went to this writing session and this guy who was really fantastic, I remember sitting down. Well, no, he was great, but I was there a handful of hours and we just banged some stuff out. And I remember getting there, and within 5 minutes, I was showing him some songs. And he was like, okay, we're not going to write anything today. Show me all of these songs and just keep doing this. He's like, whatever you're doing, like, this is working for you.
Okay.
Do this, but we're not going to get anything done today. And I kind of love that. And it was great.
Interesting.
And it was actually really fun to like get another perspective on some of these things, but
that's funny.
Yeah, it's like I think you
was he like, I don't know how to do this, but you're it's cool, so you should keep doing it.
Yeah, it was this kind of thing, like, okay, like this is like, because my songs are like, they're not gonna be number one hits, like they're all idiosyncratic and sort of strange, and like I like being on stage performing.
Yeah.
And Brian and I talk about this a lot. I love being on stage and winning a crowd over.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than that. There's nothing better than someone turning their, like, what the fuck did you just say? And to me, like, that's how I do it through music is through curveballs. I'm a knuckleball pitcher. I know I'm a knuckleball pitcher, and that's okay. You know what I mean? And I guess, to make a long story long, it's like, that's what I enjoy about the process at this point in my life.
Yeah.
And like anything, it's all fluid and due to change. But like, I like the fact that I don't know what that first line is going to be. And it's usually something that I didn't expect. And for me personally, I find that it's an exercise in sympathy.
Yeah.
Like naturally I'm not the most sympathetic person, like just as my just sort of natural demeanor. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's looking through another person's eyes for 3 minutes and 40 seconds or whatever.
That's an interesting way to do it.
Yeah. And I personally get something out of that. And I think it's everyone has their own way in.
Yeah.
For me, it's just sort of manifested over the course of my life as something a little bit, maybe a little different than the usual path. But I really enjoy that about it. And I enjoy when I can see what the other angles are that other songwriters approach songs from. So like as someone who, again, clocks in, I'm really fascinated.
So on the clocking in thing, it's obviously somewhat keeping a commercial mindset is like singing to the audience, either, about relatable subjects. So a lot of that is like
that, again, whatever the inverse of that is, that's where I am.
Like no, but there's, I mean, and I think they're like, I've done like some side projects where I've done some weird stuff. I had a little rock thing that I did during COVID with my drummer when we were, and it was like this like super anti-government, like rock weird thing. It's like, this is not necessarily like, it's definitely not mainstream country. It was not mainstream anything. But, so I think that like you like, and if your entire artistry is around something like that, I don't know if, Chris Stapleton's Steel Drivers records, a lot of those songs were like timepieces, as if they were like a Civil War bluegrass band. Like one of the songs is sang from like the perspective of the trees during a Civil War battle. Super weird, but it's cool. It worked. So like, I think there's like a way you can do things like that. And if that's your art, like, then that's sick. Mm. As a commercial mainstream writer, you unfortunately have to write
exactly
what people want when you're not writing songs for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and
do you find at this point in your life there's overlap there? Do you find that
I have a lot of overlap because I naturally like singing a lot of those things anyway. Every now and then there's a weird song that like, I don't know. I don't know if I've ever done anything that's like so left to center that people are like, whoa, what's that? Mm-hmm. I try to keep my stuff like pretty commercial, but either just musically interesting or lyrically just like a slightly different way of saying it.
Some spice and pizzazz,
yeah,
if you will.
Yeah. I try to have my stuff be unique, but like not so unique that like it couldn't be played on country radio. But that's just the lane that I like living in. And I do some weird stuff every now and then for fun, but it's just hard like finding an avenue for it since it's not like my main thing. Yeah. Like even that rock stuff is like, I put it up and it's got 2 monthly listeners and it's probably me and my drummer, you know? So it's like no one knows it. So it's hard, you know, cause there's so many things that we can do. Like, even like you said, they're like, oh, well you can have your hand in so many different pies and you can do all these different things. And it's like, man, it just everything you're doing takes so much time. And if it's not one of your main things, I mean, maybe you can have like 2 things, but it's like, I don't know if that's your lane. You're like, cool. That's what I'm doing.
Like this. I mean, like this is Brian and Alexa in my life. Like other than like, you know, again, like when you see me in jiu-jitsu or you know, or the day job, it's like this is pretty much all we do now. You know? And it's like, and you just have to. I think life is just about picking.
You know,
your
it's a lot of time.
Yeah. And it's like, and you know, your music your battles. I'm like, yeah,
you got to pick your battles. But you know, if you were like trying to also be a video game streamer and like a Chipotle food, you know, rate every location of Chipotle in the country or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, there's things that people do, and it's like, man, so many of those things take so much time. Yeah. So for me, the commercial writing is almost the main thing, and then almost my side thing is like playing shows. So
yeah,
it's like I try to have things that all kind of feed themselves. And I have this brand with some buddies that I work with called Louisiana Country Music, and I mentioned that we're starting a podcast and some other stuff. But I'm like, it also feeds the main thing. So I feel like if you have other things, they should hopefully help feed the main thing. But I don't know.
There should be some interplay with those things. They should be able to cross over in interesting ways, you know?
Yeah. But you're right, as an artist, like with your thing, it's like you can, like you're honing your artistry on what you find interesting.
Yeah, like I have, I always use this song as an example because I think it's a good way of, and Brian's heard this a million times, so I, you know, apologize to him this time. But like, I think this is a good way of expressing it. Like, so I have the song Mr. Relatable, which is about this, a movie actor who was doing real hot for a while and has fallen off and things aren't going so great.
Yeah.
But the whole song is him essentially bitching about these problems that to any listener would seem absurd.
Yeah.
Like his Bugatti got hit this past week and is in the shop and like shit like that, you know? And there's 2 ways to do that. You can either do that the cynical way, which is like the nudge, like look at this guy, like like a fuck face over here. Which to me isn't interesting. Like there's nothing interesting about that.
Yeah.
What's interesting is being on stage and having to look at the world through his eyes and being like, no, these are my it's also interesting if he is completely aware of the fact.
Yeah. That it's ridiculous.
That this is ridiculous to you, but nonetheless, these are my problems. And it's like, and I think you can tackle interesting ideas like this in
I think there are some artists that just pick one character to be their entire thing.
Yeah, true.
Like Garth Brooks.
Or
something, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Like, that's a really good point.
Where they're like, I'm playing a character here and every song is a character. Because most people just aren't that interesting. You know what I mean? Unless, I mean, obviously somebody like Jelly Roll who like did go to prison and did sell drugs and like had addiction issues and all the things that he sings about. Like, I think that's why people genuinely relate to him. But most people just aren't that interesting. So, I mean, like, I'm pretty sure like with Eric Church, like, Chief is like a character, basically. Yeah. I mean, it's an exaggerated version of himself.
I'm sure there are some. I'm sure there are some conspiracy theorists out there who are saying that Jelly Roll is a concoction made by the U.S. government. He's really, you know, they've done research. He's never spent time in any federal prison or otherwise, and it's just like, you know, like
heard it here first.
There you go, guys.
Are you guys going to create the equivalent of Garth Brooks as a serial killer?
There you go. Oh my god,
Jelly Roll's a psyop.
Yeah, Jelly Roll's a psyop.
Maybe we'll just use this podcast to push a bunch of baseless conspiracy theories.
One thing I wanted to ask you about as well was you've gotten the chance to open for a ton of heavy hitters.
Yeah.
Of all of those, I mean, like, you know, from Lynyrd Skynyrd to 38 Special to Hank Williams Jr., like, it, the list goes on and on. What are the ones that stick out for you as the big ones?
Well, those were definitely, like, the biggest, like, I was hooked up, so it's funny. I mean, obviously with the biz, everyone's like, oh, how does this happen? It's like, well, I got with a huge booking agent and had networked enough and gotten to know some of the management people and booking agents of some of those acts. Mm-hmm. And if you just know the right people, getting some of those support slots can happen, you know, if you have some stuff going on. So I was just super lucky. And actually, Lynyrd Skynyrd's management was like considering managing me at the time. They ended up not, but they let me open a bunch of shows for them for a little while. And, I mean, Lynyrd Skynyrd is like the hat that I normally wear when I'm not wearing headphones is like, yeah, looks like Ronnie Van Zandt's, like, hat.
So come
like,
on, dude, that's
I'm a huge Skynyrd fan. I actually have like a show that we do where we do like an hour of my stuff, take a little break, come back out and do like a Skynyrd tribute set with my band. So like, I'm a huge Skynyrd fan. That was like really the end all be all for me, getting to play some shows with them. And, they were all before Gary Rossington passed away, who's you know, one of the only surviving members, that like original members, and they're still touring with Johnny and Ricky Medlock, who was like in an original lineup of the band. So they're, but anyway, that was amazing. Hank Jr., I got to do a ton of shows with Hank Jr. So sick. Like, one of the first times I ever opened for him, I think we did like a casino in Iowa. It was like a big outdoor, like, kind of amphitheater vibe, and like, I got in the back of the meet and greet line with him and a guy who was playing in my band at the time, who's now a huge artist named Hardy. So we're standing in the back of the meet and greet line and we get up to the front and his like tour manager was like, hey, these guys just opened for you. And this was like, Hank's band might've already been on stage, like playing music. Like, yeah, he was like needing to get rushed onto stage. And he was like, oh, how was the show, boys? You know, we're like, crowd's sick. And he was like, man, Hank Jr. got the best fans in the world. Like, talking about himself in third person is so funny. And we're like, hell yeah, Hank, you sure do. And he was like, yeah, man, we played last night in Illinois or something. He goes, you know, it was raining. And, you know, the promoter was worried that nobody was going to show up. And he goes, it started to rain. More people show up. It's like they were growing out of the ground. I was like, hell yeah, Hank, you're a freaking like legend, dude.
You know, right there.
Yeah, it was amazing, dude. We got our picture with him. I still got it somewhere. And it was like, my drummer was like still getting his drums off the stage. He like was so mad that he didn't get in that picture. I felt really bad. But I was like, it was either that exact moment or it wasn't going to happen. So, yeah. And I've got to meet him a couple other times, like just from opening with him. He's a character. I mean, I can't imagine the life that dude's lived and not being a character, but that was really cool. I don't know. And a ton of people in the country genre, like most of the people that are famous, I've either written a song with or gotten to open for at a certain point. You know, some of my favorites, Gary Allen was like one of the coolest guys ever. I'm a huge fan of his. And then like on some of those Skynyrd shows, like Cheap Trick was on some of those and they were like, so freaking cool.
That's killer. That's really
awesome.
I'm
brain farting on the guitar player's name, Rick Nielsen. Like drummer was walking by him as he was like warming up or something. He's like, hey dude, come check this guitar out. And like, they were everyone was cool. And the 38 Special dudes got to do a bunch of shows with them and they're really cool. So I don't know. That was like a really cool time. I'm at a point where like, it's funny because those opening shows, they just pay so poorly that it's like so hard to do unless you can like eat cash or be like just used to being poor and have your band not get paid very much. I feel like I'm just like a little too old to like take $500 openers in a post COVID world. You know, a lot of those gigs pay like maybe $1,000. So, that was a really cool point in my life where I just found a way to make it work. And I guess I had the up down thing and around a lot of the times that those were happening. So I had like a way to like pay to maybe lose some money or whatever on some of those gigs. And they were great opportunities and an absolute blast. Unfortunately, I don't do a ton of those anymore, but, I'm also not with that huge booking agency anymore that put me on a lot of those. But yeah, that was a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I got some fun pictures and stories from that. You know, a lot of those bands, when they get that old, they're like, they're not like hanging out or do. They're not like, hey, we're like partying after the show. Yeah. Come hang. They're like, dude, we're going to sleep on the bus. So like, there wasn't a lot of like hanging out with them, which was like, would have been cool. You know what I mean? But
still, just the fact that you got to do that is
awesome.
Yeah,
getting to do some amphitheaters and stuff. Like we did one with Skynyrd where we like it was like a private, it was like their tour, it was their unofficial tour kickoff, and it was a private party for Zaxby's Chicken, which was just hilarious.
That
it was just
is
like, it was just so funny. And like, we're like, you know, it was a funny audience to play for, because it was like all like the management arms of like Zaxby's Chicken, and they were really cool. I mean, you know, it was just funny, just to think about some of that stuff. But yeah, man, it's been a pretty crazy little, kind of do some things that, like, I always jokingly say that like 12-year-old me would be like shitting his pants at the things that I've like gotten to be able to do, and like am just like, so, you know, like, yeah. Looking back now, I'm like, oh, yeah. You know, I'm always looking for the next thing, but I'm like, dude, I've done some pretty sweet stuff. Yeah, so
it's all perspective.
I'm very lucky. Yeah, what, definitely a lot of perspective.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about too is you had a second number one hit, I believe, yeah. with Rodgers, right? Is that
this guy, Jameson Rodgers? Yeah, yeah.
How did that transpire?
That was another one where J-Mo was in just this our friend group, and we had this song called "Some Girls" that like a bunch of big artists had like held, but ended up not recording, and. He heard us playing it at like a pass the guitar around campfire type thing in my backyard for years ago. And he was like, man, if I ever get a deal or like get a, like a cool project, I want to cut that song. And the guys that I wrote it with were just like, yeah, cool, dude. And he ended up doing it, and it was crazy. He like recorded the song in 2016, put it out in 2017. It didn't go number one until 2020.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Damn.
So...
That's a slow burn, right?
It was
there.
A very slow. Yeah, I think they went to radio with it in like May of 2019. Mm-hmm. Spent all year slowly climbing the charts. When the world shut down, it was like just far enough up the chart that like radio was like, well, we're not accepting new songs from new artists. So they just kept playing it. So it was on the radio for like a year and a half.
That's awesome.
Which was crazy.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, he's a really good dude. And that was just cool. It was cool, 'cause he was like in our friend group.
Nice.
And, he ended up having two number ones as an artist. I'm sure he'll probably have more, but, really, really good dude. And yeah, that was just a crazy thing. Like, I would have never guessed that, like, 'cause I mean, when I wrote that song, he didn't have a record deal. You know what I mean? So you're like, who knows? We were hoping somebody like, you know, that already had a record deal. You know, when you're writing a song, you're like, oh, who's famous now that could sing this? But like, that's not either of my hits. Like, neither of those guys were famous whenever I wrote those songs. So
I mean, that's even cooler though. I mean, like,
it is cool.
Honestly, I think that's really beautiful. That's awesome.
Yeah. So that was really cool. Especially the fact that they got on the radio. I mean, it would have been really cool to have like the song that I wrote for Jason Aldean be on the radio and be like, I wrote a number one for him. But it's just funny, like whenever the up down went number one for Morgan, like a lot of people didn't even know who Morgan wasn't a star at that time. Like, even when the song went number one, everyone's like, oh, we know Florida Georgia Line, and who's this new guy?
Yeah.
And then like by the time his like next song or two went number one, everyone was like, oh, everybody knew who he was. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting like having that first one, and like it was a big song, but at the same time, like,
it's different if it doesn't carry the
So thank God he became like the biggest artist in the format for me, because a lot of people just know that song even more now just because of his fame.
Yeah,
which is cool. Like, it's funny. Like little kids know that song. Like, people play it on their boat and get drunk to it. It's just like, it's kind of cool. I feel I said this a long time ago, but like I keep saying it, that like I feel like I got into playing music to like kind of you like the music that lasts is like, when you can actually like be the soundtrack to people's lives, and they like are 40, but they're like, oh, when I was 16, I blasted this song, like driving around my small town or whatever. And it's like, if you can be that, you can really have some longevity and like really have music that like people listen to for a long time. And it's like, I think that's why we kind of all get into it. But I think that's when it can really touch people. It's like when you can actually be the soundtrack to their lives. So I think, you know, those songs are possibly the only ones so far, other than, you know, a couple super fans of mine that jam my music. But, you know, the most reach that I've had has been through other artists. But, you know, I think that's kind of why I got into it. So obviously, I hope to have some songs myself that I'm singing that
get
to be the soundtrack to people's lives. And you never know.
What's next on the horizon? What do you got coming?
I've got a 5-song EP that I put out the first single from it in November. I got another one that's going to come out the first weekend of March, of April. And probably going to put them all out as singles, because it's just so hard to just like throw out too much music and have none of it. Not none of it, but it's just, you run out of things to talk about, you know what I mean? So just sprinkling it out there and trying to maximize promoting each of those tunes. So that'll get me through probably the fall, releasing some of these tunes and just playing gigs, writing, I mean, kind of the same stuff, yeah. Just, you know, trying to get, putting videos on socials of me lip syncing to my songs.
There you go.
Occasionally, you know, performing acoustic version. You know what I mean?
Just they work. Trying to figure it out. Every time I see those, they get fucking stuck in my head, dude. Like every time.
I know it's tough. I definitely didn't get into it to lip sync to my songs, but it's just like the easiest way to like, because it's funny, like you'll have like an acoustic version go viral and then everyone will be like, I don't like the album version. I want the acoustic version. And you're like, I don't want to
put this out.
Yeah, now I got to find it. It was like, oh, and you're like, that wasn't even a full version. That was just singing the chorus.
Seconds, and then I turned it off.
Yeah. So it's like, it's annoying. You like almost have to be choosy about what goes, like what you put out, but then you just want anything to go viral. So it's a crazy little game playing the whole trying to go viral on socials, but I don't know. It's annoying, but it's just part of it. So, and obviously when people discover your music, it's exciting in whatever form it is, whether it's online or I don't know. I don't feel like, I mean, people can discover your music in person now. I just feel like it's even harder, cause it's just so much out there that it's hard to have people care. Even, you know, in 2018, 2019, when I was open for a lot of those artists, like I'd had some fans discover me, but like, you think about all the huge artists you go see when you get there and like the first opener's playing, like while it's still daylight out and you're just kind of barely paying attention, you know, a couple of people that are diehards are like, oh, who's this guy? Mm-hmm. But, it's just hard breaking through, but that's why we keep doing it. Just trying to figure it out.
Well, that's good note to end on right there. That's nice. Dude, I got to say, it meant a lot that you did this. Like,
yeah.
I'm really, this was a ton of fun. This was a ton of fun.
I had a blast.
I'm so glad
you rambling.
No, dude, not at all. It was a lot of fun. And the song sounded fucking great. I'm really, really excited to hear those when they're finished up. So
yeah, those will come out good.
Thank you. I appreciate y'all. I'm excited. Dude,
of course. Thanks for doing this.
I'm excited to see this when it comes out. Hopefully it didn't sound too dumb. Thanks, guys.
Meet you.
That's fucking killing.
Yeah.
I gotta go.